From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm starts its new season Sunday. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two stars of the show, Jeff Garlin and Susie Essman. Garlin is an executive producer of Curb and plays Larry David's agent and good friend, Jeff Green. Susie Essman plays Jeff's foul-mouthed wife. They're both stand-up comics and actors. We'll also talk with Garlin about the new film he wrote, directed, and stars in called I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. And we remember a leader of the Christian right, D. James Kennedy. He founded a Florida megachurch and said he wanted to reclaim America for Christ. Kennedy died yesterday at the age of 76. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Larry David will be alienating and insulting friends, family, and strangers again, starting this Sunday when his show Curb Your Enthusiasm begins its sixth season on HBO. My guests are two stars of the show. Jeff Garland plays Larry's manager and good friend, Jeff Green. Garland is also an executive producer of Curb. Susie Essman plays Green's wife, Susie. The show relies on comic improvisation, and both Garland and Essman have done a lot of improv and stand-up comedy. Garland has also directed comedy specials by Jon Stewart and Dennis Leary. He has a new film that he wrote, directed, and stars in called I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. We'll talk about that a little later in the show. Let's start with a scene from this week's season opener of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry David, Jeff Garland, and Richard Lewis are in the locker room of the golf club discussing a friend's party.
Did you go to Funkhouse's party last night?
No. Did you?
No.
Why?
Because we're going to Danson's party tonight. It's two back-to-back, you know. I don't want to go to two parties back-to-back. It was a stupid night for him to have a party.
Yeah.
Did you call him?
No.
Well, what are you going to say?
I'll tell him Sammy was sick.
You're going to use your child to get out of a party?
So why not? It's the best thing in the
perfect,
world.
Perfect.
Crazy?
Excuse. Perfect
excuse.
No one can
excuse.
Argue with that.
Who argues with that?
I you wish can't. I had that. It's a great reason to have kids.
It's a great reason to have kids. It's one of the bonuses. Yep.
Yeah, what am I going to do? What am I going to say?
You got nothing.
I know.
Nothing.
I should show up tonight and pretend I had the wrong night.
That's stupid.
That's great.
Oh, please.
Good,
no,
right?
That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah. Ding dong. Where's the party? Isn't that a good idea?
That's a great idea.
I can buy that.
Wow.
It's such obvious bull.
No, it isn't.
No,
nobody
it's not.
Would go out of their way that much to show up at somebody's house, pretend they had the wrong night.
It's got to be a mental
case.
No,
I love
to
that.
Believe it.
That's fantastic.
Jeff Garland, Susie Essman, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start by asking you to each describe your character on Curb.
My character is best friends and with Larry David's character, which is not really Larry David, and also
his manager.
And his manager, and basically my job is to, you know, really what it comes down to was my character, a lot of exposition. I have no values. I'm not a good person. What else? You know, anything that's kind that I bring to the character is because of myself, bringing whatever I bring of myself to it. But played in someone who doesn't have any kindness or likability.
And you're a schemer also.
Oh, always a scheming.
Big time schemer.
Huge schemer, yeah. But I think, actually, here's one of the truisms for me personally of my character. I just don't want to be in trouble with my wife.
Which he is all the time.
Yes, on and off camera. So, I try and avoid that the best I can. Yeah, and Susie, you do.
My character is Jeff's wife. I play Jeff's wife, and I think my role on the show is to catch Jeff and Larry in every one of their schemes and machinations and call them out on it. I'm their nemesis.
You are a nemesis. You're an awesome nemesis.
Well, you have the mouth. I mean, you really have a mouth on the show.
What's
your favorite rant after Larry or your husband has screwed up?
You know, I think my favorite thing at this point is kicking Larry out of my house. I've done that several times.
You do it again this season.
I do it again this season. And just the phrase, get the f*** out of my house, is one of my favorite things to say.
Yeah. And it's great when you say, this year, it's really great. Because I get kicked out, so you kicked him out. That's right.
But, you know, the thing that people have to realize is that, you know, Jeff and I are like, really, really close friends. We're all really close, all four of us, Jeff and Cheryl and Larry and I. And that's how we can be so mean to each other.
Oh, yeah. People ask me all the time, how do you feel after she yells at you? I go, I feel like going to craft service. I don't even think twice about it. It means nothing to me. It's like I said, aren't you insulted? I said, the hum of the air conditioner insults me about as much.
We're just playing.
Not.
Susie, you did characters in your stand-up act that I think are slightly similar to the character you play on Curb, would you say?
You know, the character I play on Curb is kind of a composite character that I've just... I don't know how I came up with her. I mean, Larry had written that scene in the first season where I'm the fresh air fun kid
Well, yeah, but
robs us.
Well, the fresh air fun scene is where your character exploded on the scene.
Right, right.
Because I remember everyone was checking with me to see if I was okay, because you were just relentless.
Actually,
yeah.
And what happened in that scene, what was interesting is Larry basically said to me in his direction for that scene was, this was an episode called The Wire, where Jeff allows a fresh air fund kid into our house who robs us blind.
Wait, can I just start by saying the fresh air fund is run by the New York Times to send poor children to the country for a couple of weeks in the summer.
Exactly.
Okay, so go ahead.
And Larry's direction to me was basically, just don't hold back, rip him a new one. And so I'm yelling and screaming, and Larry pulls me over a couple times. He's like, it's not enough. Go further. Go further. And finally, he says to me, make fun of his fat. Make fun of how fat he is. I'm like, Larry, I can't do that. He's my friend. That's mean. I'm going to insult him. I'm going to hurt his feelings. Like, nah, he doesn't care. Just do it. Just do it. And that's when I coined the phrase, you fat.
Yeah.
And that, you know, became like my catchphrase for Jeff.
Oh, my God.
6 seasons later.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, does it bother you to be called fat on the series?
No, I am. If I was thin, I'd go, why are you calling me fat? But unfortunately, I am fat.
And handsome.
I am fat, young, and handsome. No, I'm totally cool with it. I mean, that day, I mean, really, everybody was so concerned that day with me. It's very nice that they were, Larry, you okay with that? Is it not bothering you? I go, no, I'm good. But once I said I was good, every episode after that, we were off to the races and nobody gave a damn.
You know, the other thing is we're all comics. Mm-hmm. So, like, all we really care about is the funny of it.
Yeah, it's all we care about. That's it. Is this funny? Is this real? Is it funny? Good, let's do it.
Jeff, were you one of the creators of the series? You're an executive producer. You're one of the stars. Did you co-create it too?
I wouldn't say co-create. I would say the idea was mine, and I approached a brilliant genius, you know, and I told him my idea, and he ran with it.
That was for the pilot, what became the series. Yeah, it was originally a special.
Yeah, and I approached Larry about it. Actually, I didn't even approach him. I was writing in a suite of offices at Castle Rock where Larry had his office, and I was in an office with Alan Zweibel, and one day, Larry said, who wants to go to lunch? And Zweibel couldn't go to lunch. I went to lunch with Larry. We were acquaintances. I wouldn't say we were friends at that point, but we were definitely acquaintances. And at lunch, he was talking about stand-up comedy. And I said, you know, if you ever want to do an HBO special, I have this great idea. And I told him the idea, which became Curb Your Enthusiasm. Because I had been on the road developing Dennis Leary's Lock and Load HBO special and Jon Stewart's. And while I was doing that, I thought, what a great idea for a special to see behind the scenes of what goes into making a special. And I was just going to direct it. And then Larry said, you know, no, you're going to produce it with me. And you're going to play my manager. I go, I'm going to play your manager. Yeah, you're my manager. That you'll see. It'll be great. So he already was thinking about it, you know, just from me giving him my thoughts on it.
Whose idea was it to improvise the whole thing?
Oh, mine.
That
completely.
Was yours.
Yeah.
It was your idea?
To improvise. Oh, 100%. Yes. Always going to improvise. It had to be improvised.
Why did you want it improvised?
Well, my background's in Second City, and I felt like if we had a little outline, nothing like what Larry writes today, I couldn't in my imagination think of these brilliant outlines that he writes. But I have always thought that it'd be much more naturalistic and so much more fun to do if you just had a scenario and you did it. And if you have the right performers, you can pull it off. Where we are today with the show was not in my imagination.
Well, I think it's important for people to realize, though, that there's a lot of shows that try to copy Curb,
right,
but they don't have Larry's story brain. Those outlines are so dense and so
Pages of a story, a great
story. Of a
story,
and everything we do is to service the story.
And so it's easy to improvise.
Yeah, it is.
So
for us,
the story's all there, but your lines aren't.
Correct.
Exactly. We write our own lines, if you will. But the stories are so great that it's easy
to
write your own lines.
We know who our characters are, and we know exactly what we're supposed to do in each scene.
Right.
So the dialogue writes itself.
I'm going to ask you to take a scene that you both really like from Curb and describe how you worked it out in an improvisatory process.
Let's do Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe. Or what do you want to do?
No, I'll go with Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe.
Just came into my head. Okay. Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe was an episode where Jeff and Larry decide to do Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe to decide who gives Richard Lewis their kidney. Already the premise is hilarious.
Right, because Richard Lewis is very sick and needs one.
And
he
needs a kidney. And Marty Funkhauser is... Bobby Einstein is doing the Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe. And here's the three of them. It's one of my favorite scenes. Here's the three of these grown men doing Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe. And Larry had prefigured in his head the Eeny, Meeny of who was going to end up out so that he wouldn't have to give the kidney. So my mother says to pick this one, and out goes Y-O-U. And Y-O-U was Larry, and both Jeff and Larry jump up simultaneous, screaming, and are so happy. And then this entire thing happens about out goes Y-O-U. What does that mean? Does that mean Larry's it, or he's out, or he gives the kidney, or he doesn't give the kidney? I then walk in and determine that Larry's giving the kidney because Jeff can't survive the surgery. He's too fat. And that's the scene, basically. And it's one of my favorite
that
scenes.
That was a great scene. That was great fun.
Now, what was improvised in that scene?
Everything's improvised.
Nothing.
Nothing's planned. You guys didn't plan jumping up at the same time.
No,
that
just
happened.
We just did it. That was like a second take. We just did it.
We just make it all up. It's hard to explain. But when we're in it, people always say, are you ever at a loss for what to say? Never. We've never been at a loss.
I've never been at a loss for words on there, no.
Well, why don't we hear that Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe scene?
Okay.
Who wants to be Eeny?
I'll be Eeny.
You want to be
You can be Eeny.
Okay.
I'll be Eeny. How come you want me to be Eeny?
No, it's good. You should be Eeny. That's what you want, right? Don't you want to be Eeny? Want me to be Eeny? Do you want me to be Eeny?
I'll be Eeny.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a tiger by the toe. If he hollers, let him go. My mother says to pick this one, and out goes Y-O-U.
Yeah! Yeah! Yeah!
What are you excited about?
What do you mean?
What are you so happy about?
I won!
No, you lost!
I'm just Y-O-U!
No, you lost! You're out! You're in!
No.
Yes.
No, out goes Y-O-U!
You're
the loser!
You're the loser! No, you're the loser.
Hold on a minute. Out goes Y-O-U. You give the kidney.
No.
You give the kidney.
You stupid idiots. You don't even know how to play Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe.
I don't know how to play Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe. I played Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe my whole life.
Y-O-U, you're out.
No, I'm out. Safe. Out.
No, you're
what the hell is all this screaming about?
Lose with dignity.
All right, wait a second. We're playing Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, okay?
Yeah.
Out goes Y-O-U.
Right, you're it.
Who's it?
You're it.
Out goes Y... I don't know.
No, that person's safe.
He's you.
No, and now goes Y-O-U. You're it.
You're it. You lose.
You lose.
What are you talking about anyway? You win what?
They're giving a kidney to Richard Lewis.
He's the one.
He lost.
You're not giving your kidney. What if one of your kids needs a kidney one day? You're going to give a kidney to Richard Lewis?
You'll give it to him.
I might not be the match, Larry. He needs his kidney, number one. Number two, he's a fat... He can't even survive the surgery.
You're healthy and thin.
You're giving the kidney. End of discussion. Moot point.
That's a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. My guests are two of the show's stars, Susie Essman and Jeff Garlin. Susie, how were you cast in Curb?
He walked up to me and said, "Hey, what about Susie for your wife?"
Yeah. Well, what
and
happened?
I said, "Yeah, for sure." But you can tell what led
what
to
that
point.
What happened was I had known Larry for many years ago. We all used to hang out at the comedy clubs in New York when Larry was a comic and Jeff and I were both doing stand-up at the same time. But then I hadn't seen him for years and years. He moved to L.A. and was doing Seinfeld. And then he saw me on Comedy Central do a Friar's Roast of Jerry Stiller. And I guess I popped back into his head. And I think he had that scene in mind.
And you also, on the roast, were like hammering Jerry
Stiller.
Oh,
yeah. I was really
and
brutal.
And that's when a light bulb went off.
Right. When Larry says, he said, this girl can handle that kind of language.
Do you remember what you said at the Jerry Stiller roast?
Oh, yeah. I remember a lot of it. I remember my opening line was to Alan King, where I said, "Alan, do you ever think you'd live so long that your prostate would be as big as your ego?" That was my opening line. And then it got more and more brutal from there.
If that's your starting point, holy moly.
My guests are Susie Essman and Jeff Garlin, two stars of the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guests are Jeff Garland and Susie Essman. They're comics and actors who co-star in the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Garland plays Larry David's manager, Jeff Green. Essman plays Jeff's wife, Susie. Garland also wrote, directed, and stars in the new movie I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. Jeff, I want to talk with you about your new movie and your career in a couple of minutes. But Susie, I have a few questions about your career as a stand-up. I spoke with you, Susie Essman, in 1992. And at that time,
I'm so old.
At that time, you were doing a comedy special for, I think it was for HBO.
Yeah, yeah.
And we
1992 is when I did the One Night Stand.
It was One Night Stand, yeah. Exactly. And we played a clip of your show in that 1992 interview. And I want to play that clip. And the question,
don't do this to me,
no,
Terry.
And the question that came out of it. So yeah, it's a very funny clip. So here we go.
Oh,
back to 1992 with Susie Essman.
It haunts you.
Couples, no matter how, like, you guys, you're young and you're holding hands and everything and you're all cute and perky. You end up being that couple 20 years from now that hates each other, like my aunt and uncle. They hate each other and they don't even know it. They don't even know what they sound like. My aunt will be having some serious conversation on the phone and my uncle will be in the next room screaming, "Where's my socks?" You know, so she'll be like, "You know, Gloria, it's very, very sad to find out that your son wants such a mutilating operation." "To my drawer, not your drawer. What the hell's the matter with you? You can't find a lousy sock?" And I think I speak for Ben when I say we feel for you. Speak to him. He's so gentle and understanding. "Pick up the phone, you moron. It's Gloria. She says her son is a woman trapped in a man's body." And you know, Gloria, you have to think of the positive thing. There's the shopping you could do together. You'll end up like that. Or my mother and father.
You're very funny at doing your mother and the women who you grew up around.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a time when you lived in fear of becoming them?
I still do. I catch myself making my mother's faces all the time. I always live in fear of becoming them. I feel them in my body. I am them, I think.
No, why
is it? My boyfriend's afraid of that. He's always afraid that, you know, 20 years from now, I'm going to be one of those women. And I very well may be.
Okay, that was Susie Essman in an interview we recorded 15 years ago in 1992.
You know what's so funny?
Yeah.
But listening to that, I mean, that's the Greens.
Exactly.
Exactly. Susie Green.
Exactly. That's your character now on Curb. That's perfect. So, but anyways, 15 years ago, you said that you were afraid that, you know, your boyfriend was afraid that in 20 years, you would sound like that character. You would become that character or become like your mother. So have you gotten closer to becoming that, do you think?
Well, yes, because different boyfriend. I don't remember which one was around in those days. But the one I currently have, who's staying for the rest of my life, has four teenagers. So I am now a stepmother to four teenagers. And that's really, now I really am channeling my mother. And my mother's quite enjoying it because I call her and I'll say, you know, problems I'm having with the kids. And it's just payback. You know, I'll hear her giggling on the other end of the phone. She's so enjoying my dealing with teenagers now.
So what were the sounds of the women's voices that you grew up hearing?
That was a big one. The sigh was a big one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that it wasn't so much words as sounds. Like, I've thought about doing this bit, which I never really developed, of just having a conversation with my mother and there's no words. It's just a lot of grunts and sighs. A lot of depression.
Yes, and conveying like enormous disappointment.
Yeah,
shame.
Yeah. No, it's no? Fine. You're a lot of denial. A lot of like, everything okay? Oh, everything's fine.
Now, you've said that some women comics don't have the sense of entitlement that you need to take the stage. Did you have that sense of entitlement when you started?
You know, the problem with a lot of female comics, I think, is that they have difficulty. With stand-up comics, not funny women. There's a lot of funny actresses out there. But stand-up is such an aggressive art form. And I think a lot of women have difficulty with the aggression and the hostility and the power of it. I never seemed to have that. It was something I kind of embraced. But I see that a lot of women want to be nice on stage. And nice is not really funny.
So did you have problems being not nice on stage and taking the stage at first?
I never had a problem being not nice on stage. You know, I'm not mean on stage. I mean, Susie Green could be really mean. My stage persona is not mean at all. I think it's very accessible. But it's not so much not nice and mean. It's more of a power aggressiveness thing, I think. And that there is something about stand-up comedy that's slightly adversarial. But, you know, I remember Jerry Seinfeld saying to me when I first started that he'd see me on stage and he would be like, wow, you're so bold up there. And I remember thinking he would never say that about a male comic. But, you know, I'm little and, you know, I'm this little girl. And I kind of thought what he meant was that here's this little girl getting up there and being so bold about her opinions, that somehow women were not supposed to be so bold about their opinions. And I think that's really more what it is than meanness.
Well, I really enjoy you both so much on Curb. I want to thank you both for talking with us about Curb. And Jeff, I want you to stay around. We're going to talk about your new movie. And
okay.
Susie Essman, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Susie Essman and Jeff Garland co-star in the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Its sixth season starts Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. From TIAA CREF, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jeff Garland tells us about his new movie, I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With, a comedy about a fat actor who still lives with his mother and can't seem to lose weight, find a girlfriend, or get a role. And we remember Reverend D. James Kennedy, a leader of the Christian right. He died yesterday at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic and actor Jeff Garland. He wrote, directed, and stars in the new film I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. He plays a down-on-his-luck actor who still lives with his mother.
You're going without saying goodbye?
I'm sorry, Ma. Goodbye.
You're not going to wear that shirt, are you?
Don't you see that's not even a question?
That shirt makes you look fat.
That's because I am fat.
You're not fat.
If anything, I make the shirt look fat.
Garland's character is trying to change his life, lose weight, have a lasting relationship, get a good role, but he's having a real hard time. The movie co-stars Sarah Silverman and Bonnie Hunt. Jeff Garland is also an executive producer and star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which starts its new season this weekend. He's directed comedy specials by Jon Stewart and Dennis Leary. You know, Jeff, in your new movie, there's a remake of Marty. that's being made. And Marty was the 1955 Oscar-winning movie starring Ernest Borgnine as an overweight and depressed, lonely guy who lives with his mother and thinks of himself as the kind of man who will never find love. And you think, your character thinks in the movie, I'd be perfect for this, because your character's an out-of-work actor. And he thinks, I'd be perfect for this. But of course, in the remake, everybody in the movie is like incredibly attractive.
Exactly.
And young and fit.
Yes.
It's just ridiculous. Is this a position you've actually found yourself in, where people are being, where like these like gorgeously attractive Hollywood actors are being cast in characters who are supposed to not be gorgeous?
Unequivocally, yes. Wow. It is crazy. What used to pass for a character role is now an ingenue or a young, handsome stud. It blows my mind, actually, that it's done that way.
How is the character affected by his weight compared to how you're affected?
Actually, in the movie, I would say that it's the only thing in the movie that I can say unequivocally, I love being unequivocal, is 100% exactly like how I am. That is the one thing that from personal life to screen, there is no difference between our characters. We're comfortable. We bounce around. We know that we're fat. We love to eat. We eat. The thing that I had to cut out of the movie, because all my friends who saw it didn't really quite understand it, and that is, in the movie, whenever he's sad, he eats. But I also had in the movie, whenever I'm happy, I eat. Because when you are an addict, a food addict, like I am, you know, where you just cannot control yourself, any feeling, good or bad, sends you to the Pop-Tarts.
There's a scene I want to play from your new movie, Someone to Eat Cheese With. And in this scene, you're with a friend, and he's making this observation about you.
I have lived a life of unhealthy choices.
Elaborate.
I'm an actor. How healthy is that? Wait, hold on. I'm not even an actor, okay? I got fired from Second City.
Being an actor isn't in itself unhealthy.
Okay. I stand up on stage and I say, hey, everybody, look at me, look at me. I'm worthy and good. Cheer me and applaud. Hooray for me, the actor.
Okay, I'll give you that one.
Okay. Secondly, mm-hmm. I like them young and insane. I do, okay? And someday I'd like to be married and have kids, and here I am some fat ass. By the way, that's the third thing. I'm fat assed.
Look, I'm married to an old insane woman who, by the way, when we met, was young and insane. It's not so much who you're attracted to, but you do need to lead a healthier life.
You know what? I've decided from now on, I want you to refer to me as Kitten.
You seem real comfortable with yourself, but you're not.
The magic of self-loathing.
So, Jeff Garland, do you see acting as a symptom of something, as a kind of pathology?
I actually do. Depending on the actor, and depending on it depends on the situation. But boy, oh boy, I think a lot of times with acting and sometimes with stand-up comedy, the performers that I see are working something out, and they want approval from the audience to fill some hole that they have as a person. And that may have been true of me in my younger days, but it's certainly not true. After the combination of therapy and having a family, I don't feel the need. That's actually, you know, that actually leads me to something, which is, of all the things that I do, the one that I would drop quickest is acting.
Why?
You
mean compared to like directing and writing?
Writing mm-hmm. and even stand-up. I acting to me is the least interesting because you're a conduit to whatever the writer and or director, what story they're telling. So really you're just a, you know, stand over there and say this, you know, in most instances, because the people you're working with don't want to collaborate. You just sort of stand there and do it. And I'm more than happy to do that if I'm being paid a lot. I'll do anything if I'm paid a lot.
Now, when you're on Curb Your Enthusiasm, that relies on improv. You know, Larry David
yes.
provides a story, and the characters improv their lines. But in your movie, my impression is that's pretty well scripted out.
Actually, you're the first person to say that, because everybody thinks my movie is improvised and it's pretty well scripted out. All the actors were encouraged to, if they so chose to, improvise. Most of them did not. Bonnie Hunt improvised a lot. Other than her, for the most part, it's exactly as I wrote it.
You are relatively low-key in the character, in the movie. And there are other characters who do more talking than you do. You seem more introverted than I've seen you be.
Right.
And more introverted than you seem to be now.
Well, one of the things that I was taught that really stuck with me is my job as an actor, and I look at it this way also, you know, as a director and a writer, is to make other people look good. I like making other people look good. I like making Larry David look good. Not that he wouldn't look good on his own, but to me, if everyone who's performing together is trying to make the other person look good, it raises the whole thing. I'm a great audience. I love that. So for me, that was a choice that I made in that way. It wasn't like necessarily I need to be introverted. It just sort of naturally happened that way.
Well, that leads me to the fact that you've directed comedy specials for Jon Stewart, for Dennis Leary. You directed the film version of John Waters' one-man show.
Yes, This Filthy World.
Yeah. This Filthy World, yeah, which is a lot of fun. You have a reputation for being very good at telling comics what works and what doesn't in their act.
Yes.
How do comics usually take it? Because a lot of comics seem to me to have both a very strong and a very weak ego, to be like really sure of their material but incredibly insecure at the same time.
Well, we're all that way. And I have to say that I've never first off, I don't give notes unless I'm asked. You know, I'm talking about even stuff that I'm not directing. You know, unless I have I'll say to somebody, you know why that bit doesn't work as well, or you know what can make that bit better, and then I'll give them one little note, and then they're like, I didn't even think of that, and they're always happy, because I can see that they're frustrated that a piece is not working as well as it should. However, when, like, you know, I remember I was giving Larry David notes, when we were doing the hour special, because there was a lot of his stand-up in there. And that was part of my job. But he was very resistant to it. And I didn't want to have because this is their point of view, their art, you know. And one of the fun things about doing stand-up is the lack of interference of other people. So I think that Dennis, Leary, and Jon Stewart, everyone's very hesitant. But it gets to a trust point where they can see that I'm not trying to dominate their act. I'm just making these suggestions so they get to where they want to be, as opposed. I jump around a lot. But that's my job on Curb Your Enthusiasm. My job as a producer and an actor is to tell Larry David's story. What is Larry David's vision? I want to get that up on the screen.
My guest is Jeff Garland, a co-star and executive producer of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He wrote, directed, and stars in the new film, I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeff Garland. He's one of the stars and is an executive producer of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which starts its new season on Sunday. He also wrote, directed, and stars in a new movie, which is called I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With, which also stars Sarah Silverman. Now, I know as a child you had a heart problem. Did you grow up thinking of yourself as frail and vulnerable?
Yes. Once I was diagnosed with my heart problem, and I had the heart problems. Up until then, I played a lot of sports, baseball and football. I was on the high school football team, all that sort of stuff. But what it did was, and it helped me so much with what I do now, is it made me so much more of a vulnerable person, so much more of a sensitive person. And I really see things through other people's eyes quite often. And I can be very sensitive. And as someone who does what I do, that really is a strength, you know, to be vulnerable. I think that, like, my idol in terms of stand-up is Richard Pryor. There's nobody ever who's been more vulnerable on stage than Richard Pryor. So it really did help me. So I think it was a good thing in terms of who I am today. I don't know that I would have made it as a comedian, at least the kind of comedian that I am today, if I hadn't had these illnesses as a kid.
Was being Jewish an important part of your childhood?
I'm an observant Jew, but I'm not Baron von Religious when it comes to Judaism. The only thing that was negative for me about being Jewish was when my family moved from Chicago to Florida when I was in sixth grade. We moved to South Florida. And South Florida, as I knew it prior to that, was my grandparents' condominium, which was chock full of Jews. And so I went to a school where I'd be the only Jew in a class, and these Southern kids wanted to fight me all the time. And I'd get into a lot of fights, but my humor got me out of a lot of fights, too.
What would you say?
Oh, I don't remember, but if you make somebody laugh, you disarm them. And so if I made everybody laugh, they were disarmed. But sometimes, you know, you're dealing with people that don't have the greatest sense of humor. They want to beat up a Jew, so they're not really like, I love comedy. And so I'd have to get into a fight. But I did okay because, you know, I was always a big kid, you know, big, strong kid. So it wasn't a problem for me.
Well, do you remember your first time on stage doing stand-up?
Yes. It was horrifying. Now, mind you, my first time on stage, I had my heart problem, and I was scared, silly, and you know, fear would cause tachycardia in me. I had this thing called WPW, which is where your heart beats, can suddenly just, it goes into ranges that you can't believe so fast, and you think you're going to die, and it hurts and whatever. So I was scared on that level. I also was, I was the funniest kid in school, and I was really funny at home. I sat my parents down before I was going out to do my 5 minutes. You got 5 minutes. And I'm not making up. These are people that laughed at me all the time. They gave me my first laugh. So I did my act for them, and they stared at me. But now looking back on it, I don't blame them for staring at me, because when I think about what I did, it was a bunch of stupid jokes like I would say to the, I remember when I at school I would say to the teacher, can I go to the bathroom? She'd say, I don't know, can you? And then I'd pee all over her desk, you know, like horrible jokes. And then I did a monologue from Stripes,
the Bill Murray movie.
I did Bill Murray as an actor is my hero, my idol, he's the best ever. I love so much of what he did in Stripes. But at the time, there's a monologue where he's going around the room. Everyone's introducing themselves. And then he introduces himself and he says, you know, to Lee Harvey, you are a madman. When you stole that cow and your friends tried to make you with the cow, man, I want to party with you, cowboy. I was like, this whole monologue that he does. And I did it for my act. Oh, my God, what an idiot I was.
So,
but I passed auditions. I passed auditions my first night.
What about your heart? How did your heart do that first night?
The heart, I actually did okay the first night. But it was quite, you know, they said, you know, I remember the doctor saying, stay away from stressful situations if you can avoid them, which is such a weird thing for a doctor to say, because at the time I didn't know. But how do you avoid stressful situations in life? So I was on a medication called Inderol, which was very helpful. But I remember one night at Second City, I was doing a scene, and then all of a sudden my heart went berserk, like faster than it's ever gone before and more painful than it's ever been before. And I remember, I don't know how I did it. I finished the scene, and I told the actors, I go, I can't do anymore. You got to cover for me. I can't do anymore. And I went into this little hallway behind the stage, and I laid on the ground there, and I was sure I was going to die. Positive I was going to die. And when it all calmed down, I developed horrible stage fright for quite a while.
How'd you get over that? And also, it must have hurt your reputation initially to have backed out of a role in the middle of a performance like that.
Well, here, let's even go here for a second. When I was developing in Chicago, I was a stand-up comedian and I was also an improvisational actor at Second City. I had this thing where at Second City, for example, the audiences loved me, but my peers did not respect me. And then if I went to a stand-up club, the audiences would stare at me, but the comedians would be in the back laughing. They thought I was great. So it all evened out over a period of time. But so at Second City, I didn't have the greatest reputation as an improviser, and I wasn't respected by my peers. So that was not a happy time thinking back on it. I learned so much at Second City, but on a professional level, it really got to me. It knocked me down the way I was treated by my peers. And then in terms of getting over the stage fright, I learned through my own experience that the only way to get over stage fright is to keep going up on stage. I want to say I had stage fright so bad where if I had a stand-up set and there were six people in the audience, I'd still be throwing up before I went up because I was horrified to go up.
Now, your wife is a casting director, and among the movies she cast is 40-Year-Old Virgin and your new film.
Yes.
Do people assume that when they meet you that your wife should really be the character of your wife on Larry David because they're so used to seeing you with her?
Not in that way, but I have to remember when I'm doing stand-up, when I refer to my wife, to say that Susie is not my wife and sort of kind of describe my wife so they get a different image in their head when I tell these stories, because I was realizing that, my God, they're thinking of Susie when I say my wife, and they were. Almost every time. So it's only affected me in stand-up on a personal level. People like my wife so much more than me. They really do.
Can you give an example of a story you've told in your stand-up act where you've had to explain that your real wife isn't your wife on Curb?
Yeah, well, I basically point out that my wife would never call me a fat although she thinks it. I know that she thinks it, because I'll be getting into the shower and she'll have this look of disdain on her face and I'll say, what? What? I know what she's thinking.
Well, Jeff Garland, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's been an honor.
Jeff Garland wrote, directed, and stars in the new movie, I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With, and you can see him on Curb Your Enthusiasm, which starts again Sunday. Coming up, we remember a leader of the Christian right, Reverend D. James Kennedy. This is Fresh Air. The Reverend D. James Kennedy, a televangelist and powerful figure within the Christian right, died yesterday of complications from an earlier heart attack. He was 76. Kennedy was the pastor of a Florida megachurch. His radio and TV programs were carried in approximately 200 countries. Kennedy founded the Center for Christian Statesmanship, which offered Bible studies to members of Congress and their staffers. His group, the Center for Reclaiming America, was created with the goal of reclaiming America for Christ. Kennedy said, "It is a myth that our country was founded on the principle of separation of church and state. America was founded upon Christ and his word." He despaired that this foundation was crumbling in our time. He was active in what he described as the key fronts of the culture wars. This included opposing the teaching of evolution. I spoke with Kennedy in 2005. You run the Center for Reclaiming America, and you also run an annual conference called Reclaiming America for Christ.
Yes,
and you've described your goal as Reclaiming America for Christ. What does that mean?
Well, John Jay, whom, as you know, was the first Chief Justice of the first Supreme Court, and, of course, one of the three men that wrote the Federalist Papers that sold the Constitution to America, and one of the chief of the Founding Fathers, he put it this way. He said, that God in his providence has given to us a Christian nation, and it behooves us as Christians to prefer and select Christians to rule over us. Well, that was the Christian perspective of most of the founders in the beginning of this country. And therefore, we believe that the Christian view of morality and life is the one that should prevail in America.
Well, in terms of how what you would like to see, would if you want to reclaim America for Christ, does that mean that the people who sit in our courts, the judges, our politicians, the people in Congress, our president, should they be Christians? And should they be Christians as opposed to Jews or Buddhists or Muslims or people who are secular?
Well, let's be, you know, open about this. We have people who are secular and humanists and unbelievers who are constantly supporting in every way possible other people who share those views. And I don't object to that. That's their privilege. And I think that Christians should be allowed the same privilege to vote for people whom they believe share their views about life and government, and that's all that I'm talking about.
Have you thought about how the expression reclaiming America for Christ sounds to Jews, to Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs, Hindus, people who are secular, not to mention to Christians who interpret the Bible differently than you do?
Unfortunately, historically, the Christian foundation of America has been expurgated from all of our textbooks in our schools. And so the average American today, having come through our public schools, knows nothing about it. But I would say that certainly it seems to me that when I talk to people who are secularists or skeptics or atheists, and they are supporting people who have those views, I don't say to them, you know, how dare you support someone that agrees with you? I mean, that's what all Americans do.
You run something, a conference every year that's called Reclaiming America for Christ. What is the goal of the conference? How many people come? What are its political goals and its spiritual goals?
The purpose of the conference of Reclaiming America for Christ is the same as for the center, and that is to try to help Christians realize that they have a responsibility to their culture. If you go back 20 years ago, a study showed that half the Christians in this country were not even registered to vote, and that of those that were registered, half of them didn't vote. And trying to show them that as Christians, we have a responsibility to try to bring to light in a community the teachings of God. God has things to say not only about church and family and individual lives, but he has things to say about education and about government and about arts and about everything else. So therefore, we should, as Christ said, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. So Christ would like to bring to bear his teachings. Now, when we have turned our back on those teachings, we have had court rulings for pornography and obscenity and abortion and partial birth abortion and sodomy and gay marriage and on and on and on it goes, that have brought in the minds of the majority of Americans a great deal of suffering and woe to this country.
What are some of the typical dilemmas that you think Christian politicians face in terms of following their faith and doing their job in public office? Let me give you like the classic example that is often asked about in this context. If you are a Christian judge and a case comes before you about, for instance, abortion, and abortion is legal in our country and legal in the state that the judge is in, does the judge follow his conscience as a Christian if he is a Christian that subscribes to your interpretation of Christianity, or does he uphold the law?
Well, let me give you an analogy, if I may. In Nazi Germany, it was legal, according to the High Court of Germany, that Jews were not persons and they had no rights. and therefore it was perfectly legal to kill them. Now, if you, I'm sure, believe that human beings have rights and that Jews have rights, if you were a judge in that situation and you were, they're bringing some people that they want to take and kill, and that's the law, which side would you come down on that dilemma? A politician would say, it's the law, kill them. A statesman would say, it's not right, and therefore I will not approve of it. And in Nuremberg, in the trials after the Second World War, the Nazi attorneys were very smart, and they threw the Allied attorneys for about a 90-yard loss when they began to condemn the Nazis for all of these people, the Jews and so on, that they had killed and all the other things that they had done. And they said to them, all of these things that we have done were legal according to the laws of Germany, Nazi Germany. And here you come here, strangers and aliens from outside our country, trying to impose your views upon our nation. And since we have taught in our own colleges over here that that morals and mores are and laws are relativistic and change with the society, we've been teaching that for 40, 50 years in America, or longer than that, actually. How can you do that? And our lawyers didn't know what to do because the Nazi lawyers were right. That's what we had been teaching, and we were violating our own principles, which principles I believe were wrong. And so now you apply that same thing in the situation you described, and I think you'll get the answer.
The Reverend D. James Kennedy recorded in 2005. He died yesterday at the age of 76. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a former Bush administration official describes his conflicts with the administration over executive power. Jack Goldsmith was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel. He resigned after withdrawing the two now infamous torture memos, which were written in the office before he headed it. Join us for the next Fresh Air.